Function Room 50, talking ballots. This week, I'm joined by another returnee to the Function Room, Adrian Kavanagh. He's a lecturer at the Maynooth University Department of Geography, and we're talking about voting systems and the numbers they generate and the little bit of maths involved. We catch an STV, single transferable vote, the FPTP, first past the post, and the French system, which gives you a second go. We find out why Eurovision is a giant democratic experiment, and ultimately why a vote in Ireland goes on an adventure. Before we go to Adrian, I thought maybe for people listening outside of Ireland, it's worth just giving a brief introduction to Ireland's method of voting called the single transferable vote. So good, it needs to be explained twice, because you'll hear about it later as well. And in fact, it's not a brief introduction. I'm not sure that's possible. It's set up and in order to ensure as proportional an outcome as possible, so that the number of people who vote for a particular party is represented by the number of seats they get. That's the intention anyway. So what happens is you go into an Irish polling booth, you get your ballot paper, there's often a ton of candidates, and instead of just picking one, you rank them in order of preference, and you can do as many choices as you want. Start at one, work all the way down, or some people start at the end and work their way back in terms of least hatred. When the vote count starts then, all the ballot papers spill out of the box. First of all the votes are checked to make sure you haven't spoiled them in various ways. That's fairly common in any democracy. So you can spoil them accidentally by putting in the same preference twice or that kind of thing. Or by, I don't know, drawing genitals and boobs on them. Anyway, once the total valid poll is known, then a thing called the quota is calculated. So the quota is the total number of votes you need to guarantee being elected as a candidate. And it's calculated as follows. Warning, contains a formula. So the quota is equal to the total votes divided by the number of seats in the constituency plus one. And then you add one to that answer. So if there were 10,000 votes in a constituency which had four seats, the quota would be 10,000 divided by 4 plus 1, which is 5. So that's 10,000 divided by 5, which is 2,000. And then you add 1. So that becomes 2001. By the way, that's known as the Droop quota, named after English mathematician Henry Richmond Droop. There's no need for you to know that, really. It's just so that you know it's Droop, an actual person's name, rather than any dysfunction associated with brewers. So the reason it's calculated this way, the quota, is a number of reasons. First of all, fair representation. So it means that each elected candidate represents approximately the same number of voters, right? So we've lots of first preferences and then the spare ones, which will come to get passed out amongst others. So it provides some sort of proportional representation. Majority rule. So by dividing the total votes by the number of seats plus one and then adding one, it means that the number of votes needed to be elected is just more than the number of votes that can be cast for each seat. So if there's four seats in a constituency, that's whatever, 2,000 votes per seat. This just means that there's more candidates. It prevents more candidates from being elected than there are seats available. And then efficiency, they add one vote to the answer when you do the dividing to make sure that the quota is met exactly and prevents any ties, any draws between candidates. So then one person is elected, and then if your first preference gets elected first time out by reaching the quota, their spare votes, the ones they don't need, are then distributed based on the second preferences on those votes. So those spare votes don't go to waste. Then they eliminate the lowest candidate, the person, the usual mentalist who got six votes, and they distribute their second preferences among all the other candidates, whatever is available. Not always, most of the time, these second preferences haven't been filled out, or they go to other mad yokes. But anyway, so they're distributed. Then if there's anybody has gone reached the quota after that, then they're elected. And then the next lowest is eliminated. And this continues on until you've filled all the seats. So that way your vote, it could be counted a number of times. I mean, we'll talk about this again, but it's just to tee it up, because obviously this is coming in through your ears and it's hard to visualise. Just to let you know, it's not a bad system. Anyway, we'll talk about it again, but now it's time to meet Adrian again, for those who've heard him the first time talking about the presidential election. But this time he's talking about the three more recent elections in Europe. Over to Adrian.
I'm Adrian Kavanagh. I'm a lecturer in the Department of Geography in Maynooth University. And my main research interest is focusing on the geography of elections and sometimes the geography of the Eurovision Song Contest.
We'll get to that, definitely. I think the first thing to note is to remind people who think geography is just hanging valleys and oxbow lakes that geography is intrinsic to our democracy. And then when you start to think about it, you go, well, of course, because people live in places and elections are distributed in places and all that kind of thing. Why is geography so important in democracy?
It's so important. You actually gave a very good explanation there yourself, Colm, probably better than I would. But yeah, it is, as you say, we live in places. So the places that we live in will shape how we behave, but they'll also shape our voting behaviour. But at the other dimension, at the other side of the scale, there is a geography to elections. We're speaking now, I don't know when this might go out, but like as we're speaking now, we're less than a week away from the UK general election. And there was very distinct geographies of voting there. But even geographies in terms of where the Liberal Democrats were making their gains, where Labour were making their gains. So you could see, for instance, there was a big cluster of Labour gains in certain parts of the country, most notably the north of England and Scotland. Whereas while Liberal Democrats made a number of gains, a lot of their gains would have been particularly clustered in the south and southwest of England. So there is a geography of elections. Partly that's shaped by social factors. For instance, certain types of areas might have a higher percentage of older voters or a higher percentage of younger voters. Certain areas might have a higher percentage of middle-class people or working-class people. Certain areas may be more rural or urban. So all these factors can play a fact. But sometimes it can be simply down to the politicians themselves. Have you a good local politician who, irrespective of the social or demographic makeup of the area, can they carve out a support base for themselves and maintain that support base, even at times when support for their own political party is on the down low?
And it's funny, like we could literally do an episode for a geography podcast on elections and a ton of other things. But as a mathematical podcast, I'm interested in elections, of course, for the numbers involved. Three elections recently. Ireland did the European elections and the local elections. The UK had their elections and France had theirs. So that gave us an opportunity. And then coming up in November, there's all the wonderful absolute chaos and excitement of an American general election, or indeed presidential election with bits of general election tacked on. When you look at across the various systems, can we talk about the various systems first of all, in terms of, you know, first past the post, like the popularity contest seems very simple. What's good, what's bad about a very simple thing that says, I've got more votes than you, it's my seat?
First past the post is, as you said, Colm, that's probably one of the main gains with that system. It's very simple. When it comes to running an election, when people are going in to vote, they just go in, they find the name of the party or the candidate, put an X beside the box. The process of voting probably takes only a matter of seconds to do. Counting is very fast. If people were watching the UK coverage, people who might be used to the Irish elections and might say, okay, the voting's over at 10, so we won't know the result for a few days, would have got a big shock with the UK election, because we probably knew the general result literally within a few seconds of polls closing on election night. And all bar two constituencies were, all the counting in all bar two constituencies was over literally by 9 o'clock the following morning. ghastly system, in my opinion, but that's beside the point.
Yeah.
All that fun, but it's very simple, very straightforward. Those of us who did wait up a few hours to see the start of the counting process will have been looking at, say, Blyde and Sunderland and Newcastle and the madness where they're trying to see which constituency would have the first declared result. And I think it was, Sunderland South and Houghton, was the, I don't think I have the name correct, but it's definitely Sunderland and probably something Southie in Sunderland. They were the first constituency to have the result out. And that is literally less than an hour after polls closed. So it's a very straightforward system in terms of the voting and the counting. It's very straightforward in terms of how you form governments, because this first past the post electoral system, because of the high levels of disproportionality that's part of it, it does tend to produce very clear-cut results.
Yeah.
You generally tend to find, as in the UK, most elections, you have a one-party government at the end of the process. And literally, less than 24 hours after the polls are closed, if there's a change of government, the change of government has taken place within those 24 hours. It's generally very... The only exception in my living memory of an election where it took a few days to work things out was the 2010 general election. And in that case, it was, probably about 4 or 5 days before the Conservatives and Liberal Democrats came together to form a government. In Ireland, in the last general election, I think it took us about 4 months before we formed a government.
And some would argue that we were fine.
Yeah, that could be argued as well, to be honest. And I think in Belgium, they've had periods of over a year where...
That's right.
So it's a very clear-cut system. That's the main advantages.
When you vote, it feels like with first past the post, there is more pressure on the individual vote to be right, or for you to do the,
the right thing,
to know what you're voting for, because it's so binary. Isn't that right?
It is. It's very straightforward. Like,
There's
been a lot of talk about the last week's election in the UK. Labour gained a little more than 1% of the vote, but they ended up definitely more than doubling their number of seats. That's probably down to one aspect that you do get with this system, tactical voting. The general argument is, why did this happen? Why did the Liberal Democrats make so many gains with a very slight increase in their share of the vote, the same with Labour? There does seem to be a sense in last week's UK general election that tactical voting was pretty strong in that election, that in parts of England where it looked as if the Liberal Democrats were going to be the biggest challenge to the Conservatives, the general suggestion is probably Labour voters, maybe in those areas, may have decided to vote Liberal Democrat in those areas. And maybe, say, in the north of England, Liberal Democrat-leaning voters may have decided to vote Labour. So this tactical voting element is an important part of the process. Because otherwise, you're running the risk of having a situation where your vote is what we call a wasted vote.
Mm.
A wasted vote is basically a vote for a candidate that doesn't win the seat. But in this wider context, a wasted vote might be looked on as cases where you vote for a candidate who you know isn't going to win, has no chance of winning that seat. And there are a lot of wasted votes in first-past-the-post elections. Generally, you tend to find that a very large percentage of votes that are cast are effectively wasted votes. I think in the last week's election, maybe something like 58% of all the votes, possibly.
There's a big kind of a philosophical thing at the heart of this of like you still get to do what you want, but it's a question of whether of your influence, the amount of influence your vote can have. Like, if you stood back from the UK election and said, whatever, there's 600 votes, like individual votes taking place, and whoever won, everybody, the majority in each constituency got what they wanted. So you have 600 happy majorities and 600 disgruntled losers. Is there a philosophical thing about whether that's too much disgruntlement? Whereas when you go for proportional, that's somehow people are less ecstatic, but also less unhappy.
And the thing is, as well, in a lot of those 650 constituencies, the candidate who won the election was winning it with maybe 30% of the vote, sometimes, I think there was a few where it was in the high 20s. So the level of disgruntlement is even higher. It's probably possibly, if you factor that in, so there's probably about 60% of the country are disgruntled voters. I think that's the main disadvantage of the system, that so many voices are effectively discarded when it comes to adding up who gets into parliament. So it's sort of like, it's a kind of a weighing up mechanism. Do you want, and this is to borrow Theresa May's term, strong and stable government, which the first past the post system will give you, because it gives you a very clear cut result. Or do you want a fair system where more people's voices are better represented in terms of who gets into parliament, and where there's a much clearer relationship between the percentage of the vote parties win and the percentage of seats they get? And there's also less of a fear that if you go to vote, that your vote will effectively count for nothing.
So in single transferable vote, and we'll come to France in a minute, in Ireland, people would be reasonably familiar with it. But just to give people outside of Ireland that insight in, it's very, obviously it can be complicated, but a brief thing, talking about the transferable nature, how a vote has a number of lives.
True.
And that, and also why there are far less wasted votes.
Yeah, it's a really interesting one. So a few weeks ago, Colin, we had the local and European elections. Now, I was lucky enough to be in the one constituency in Ireland, well, one of two constituencies in Ireland, where, apart from Limerick, which had the mayoral election, which is sort of cheating in terms of that, but that's beside the point. Portlaoise and Drogheda Urban, we had, in both constituencies, we had 20 local election candidates and 27 European election candidates. So 47 choices. I obviously used every one of those choices. We vote differently in single transferable vote electoral systems. A few minutes ago, I was talking about the UK election, where you just go in, put an X beside the candidate, and you walk out. A few weeks ago, as I said, in my case, I had 47 candidates to pick from across two different ballot papers. In fairness, I went through it quick enough, but like if it was a bit slower, I probably should have been bringing in a pack of sandwiches and a flask of tea. So voting, if you use all your preferences, voting can take a while in the Irish system. If you use all your preferences. And why would you use all your preferences? Well, in theory, but also in reality, there's a good chance, say, in that 27 candidate constituency, Midlands Northwest, there's a theoretical chance that maybe your 26th preference could decide who wins the last seat. Maybe less so in European elections, but definitely in local elections where we have a smaller number of voters across constituencies, and a small number of votes can decide who's eliminated from a count, or a small number of votes can decide who takes the last seat or last seats in the constituency. So voting is, you can still do what they do in the UK and vote for just one candidate, but you can use, in Ireland, most of us do vote in order of preference, and the number of preferences that you have is effectively the same as the number of candidates running in a constituency. So Midlands Northwest, we had 27 preferences. In the Portlaoise local election constituency, we had 20. Now, when it comes to counting, on the first count, the counters will just look at the first preference votes in each constituency. So when they look at a ballot paper, they look for the number one, which see which candidate's got the number one, and that candidate gets that vote. Now, at the end of what we call the first count, now, in the UK, in the USA, in first-past-the-post electoral systems, there is no further counts. There's just one count. But in Ireland, we have a number of counts to decide who wins the seats in our constituencies. So in a hypothetical five-seat constituency, you'll have your count. And once all the votes are counted, they work out what the quota for that constituency is. Now, the quota, in mathematical terms, is the smallest number of votes that only five candidates can get in that constituency. Because obviously, you don't want a scenario where you accidentally calculate the quota and you get six candidates elected in a five-seater. So ultimately, to be elected in a constituency, you need to do two things. Number one, hit the quota in terms of your number of votes, either on the first count or in any later count. Or secondly, if you don't hit the quota, you need to be the last woman or man standing. So we do have a scenario in most constituencies in Ireland where you have maybe five seats to be won, maybe only three candidates hit the quota, but the last two seats are filled by two candidates who don't hit the quota, but they're the last two candidates standing because all the other candidates are eliminated. So in a count, first count, the count of votes will say no candidate is elected. What happens in that scenario then is the lowest placed candidate will be eliminated and their votes will then be transferred. So the counters will then take that candidate's votes and they'll look at to see which candidate gets the number two on those ballot papers.
And so it, and then of course that repeats up. The impact of that is that even if your first preference is for somebody who, I don't know, believes the earth is flat, that and you, but you continue to vote down through the, and they're never going to get in. Well, not not for another decade anyway. Or although
maybe another 2 years, maybe
2 years. But with the level of the rise of stupid. So therefore, that would have been a wasted vote.
That would have been
in first past the post. So there's a chance that your second preference can do something. Do we have a sense? Would you have a sense on in a single transferable vote system? How many votes have some impact? Like, obviously, your second transferable vote might be to somebody, your second preference might be somebody who believes the earth is round, but believes fervently that we are spraying the clouds with drugs to keep us docile, right? You know what I mean? Gradually getting less and less insane. But at some point, your vote might actually have an impact up along the way. If you mention, say, up to 60% of votes are wasted in a first past the post, in a single transferable vote system, would you say that it's 30% are wasted or 20%?
If you take away, say, non-transferable votes, in theory, say, in a five-seater constituency, a five-seat constituency, in theory, less than one-sixth of all the votes would be wasted in that scenario.
Okay.
So it's a much smaller percentage of wasted votes, which is good.
So the democratic power of a group of people, of a group of 40,000 people in a constituency is
much higher.
It might be twice as high as the equivalent 40,000 in a first past the post.
So, for instance, in that 5C constituency I'm talking about, if you vote, if you use all your preferences, there's probably, probably about 80, 85% chance that your vote will go to elect someone. The only way it won't go to elect someone is if the vote finishes off with the candidate who's eliminated in the last count.
Yeah.
That's where your vote ends up.
I know,
But that's that's still quite a small percentage of the overall vote. So by and large, in probably about 70-80% of the cases, if you use all of your preferences, and I'd always encourage that, chances are your vote will go to elect someone. It might be your first preference. It might be your 12th preference. It might even be your 26th preference.
The other thing, I suppose, is that it reflects the way life is, which is that you hate somebody for their social policies, but admire their fiscal discipline, or you hate somebody for their position on the environment, but they are very good at getting small jobs done locally for individuals. So it allows you to vote based on the complexity of the spectrum of human existence.
It does, because there is a lot of choices to be made if you've got, say, a 20-candidate constituency, which I suspect we'll have maybe a few 15, 16, 17, 18, 20-candidate constituencies in the upcoming general election. It does allow you there to weigh up choices like, okay, when you're given your 12 preference, what's the most important thing in terms of that? Or are you just someone who, if you're using all your preferences, as I did with the European elections. I knew very clearly who I wanted to give 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 to. I knew who I wanted to give 24, 26, 25, 26, 27 to. But then it's that middle ground, which is harder to choose.
Okay, so England, UK, very binary. Ireland, you vote in a cloud. France, you vote twice. Yes, yeah. You get to change your mind. What's the proportionality read on a two-round vote then and getting a second chance? Like, it's almost, I mean, the French general election was like getting two bites at a referendum in some ways. What do you think of a two-round election in general for
the proportionality? Yeah, the two-round election, to me, in terms of what it ultimately achieves, say, at a constituency level, to me, it doesn't seem that far removed from a by-election result where you're getting one candidate elected from one of our single transferable vote constituencies. Because what you're seeing there is effectively a process where you're whittling down the number of candidates. But if you're going to be the candidate to win a constituency, in the second round, you've got to win over half the votes to win that seat. So it does, as we saw with the National Rally, a party that's winning 30% of the vote, but maybe is very disliked by 60 to 70% of the voters, this sort of system does penalise them. So we saw with the National Rally, they looked very good. The results in the first round of voting looked very good. But when you came to the second round, especially when you had a number of candidates dropping out, where you had these triangle M's, where you had three candidates left in the running, which was an interesting scenario that, I'll be honest, I didn't know much about until I saw it last week.
Just to jump in there, sorry, that's triangle M. So in the second round, so how many candidates would be in a second round then, typically?
Yeah, so my normal understanding was, it's always two candidates. I don't know about presidential elections, but for these French parliamentary elections, the number of candidates are allowed to progress to the second round, the top two candidates, and then any other candidate who wins at least 12.5% of all the registered votes in that constituency. So 12.5% of the electorate. Now, normally in a French election, normally the number of candidates that you'd get in that scenario would be quite low. But because voter turnout was quite high for these elections, there was a lot of these, my French has gone triangle M's, if I can say, a lot more than normal for these elections. And in fact, I think in a few constituencies, there was a quadruple M's scenario where you actually had four candidates left in the race. Again, it was down to turnout. Now, what happened in France was that, again, and this is part of, I think this is one of the parts of the interesting things about electoral systems is how political parties maneuver them. What happened in France was there was strategic withdrawals of these third place candidates in constituencies where maybe the National Rally had won in the first count. And then when it came to the second round of voting there at last weekend, the things had very much shifted. So the National Rally were the lead party in the first round. On the second round, the Left Alliance were now the biggest party, biggest grouping. Macron's ensemble grouping was then the second largest grouping, and then the National Rally were down to the third largest grouping. Obviously, a much better result for the National Rally, the old National Front, than in previous elections, but up until last Sunday, they were very seriously thinking about a likelihood that they could be form the next government in France. So, it's an interesting system. I think it's possibly a system. It is quite first past the post in some ways, but in other ways, it does keep elements of our single transferable vote system, that there is a chance to make sure that the candidate who is elected at the end is the one that's liked, or at least not violently disliked by half of the voters in that constituency.
Yeah, because that's what it struck me as, that it was a measure of strength of feeling, you know, in the terms of like, I like this candidate X, but I hate the other candidate 2X. Therefore, you know, maybe this milquetoast, I don't even know, I've never said that word out loud, but this milquetoast candidate will do. And indeed, I was looking it up. Apparently, France's two-stage electoral system was developed by a mathematician, Marie-Jean Condorcet, during the revolution. He wanted to avoid a vocal minority usurping the silent majority. So therefore, the people who were cowed into complacency by a loud movement got to flex their democratic muscles in the second stage with a bit of thought.
What a great idea. I'm sure he went on to live a long and prosperous life.
Yeah, well, I don't know. If it was during the revolution, I don't know what statistical chance you'd give him of making it through the terror and all that. Coming up in part two, we talk Eurovision and American swing states, but also a word on the guy we mentioned just there, Marquis de Condorcet. Adrian hoped he lived a happy life, but those were difficult times to live a long and happy life. He was part of the French Revolution and he was pro-revolution, but like all revolutions, the first thing on the agenda is the split, to quote Brendan Behan. So he fell foul of the Montagnards, who were one faction. After the revolution, he was branded a traitor. He fled and hid. And then, according to legend, his identity was uncovered when, in some inn or tavern, he ordered an extravagant 12-egg omelette. And people found out who he was. He was arrested. He died by poison, or which was either self-inflicted, or he was murdered in prison. Now, apart from omelets and all of that, by all accounts, he was a good egg. He campaigned against slavery and for women's rights. Do have a look at him. He also wrote papers on integral calculus. So, which is appropriate because increasing the power by one and dividing down by the new power is a perfect phrase for what happens just after a revolution. That's a terrible pun. Anyway, let's get back to elections and Eurovisions after the ads. It's interesting, though, because, and you must find this, that these systems have, you know, obviously developed sometimes by mathematicians, but they've developed often as a checks and balance against, against democracy, the inherent weakness of democracy, which is like, what if the majority vote for an asshole, bad person?
True. And like in terms of our own electoral system, our electoral system basically was a checks and balance to ensure that the unionist minority in the Republic of Ireland would still have a chance of having a say in our parliament.
Okay.
Now, what's interesting was most countries that use proportional electoral systems use a form of list system. So Germany is probably the most famous. You have an even more extreme version of a list system in the Netherlands. But we ended up with the single transferable vote system because that was the system that was most popular in British academic circles in the 1910s, and we inherited. But it's almost become as Irish now as the county system.
Yeah.
Again, another import from Britain.
Yeah. So it was as English as cream tea.
Yes.
And now it's as Irish as having your dinner in the middle of the day.
And rightfully so.
Yeah. The list system, is that where you're given a list of candidates and when they count up all the votes, they kind of distribute the votes proportionately among the parties, is it?
Yeah, ultimately, at the end of the election, there is a constituency vote, but then there's extra seats then added to the parties based on the most important votes. So when you go to vote, you will vote for a constituency candidate, but the most important vote really in terms of determining the overall number of seats parties win in the parliament is this second vote or party vote. And that determines the percentage of votes you win here will determine how many seats you win, say, in the Bundestag in Germany, for instance. Now, there are checks and balances here. In Germany, the main check and balance they use there is they have a 5% threshold. So you don't get this top-up seat from the second vote unless you get 5% of the national votes, or you win at least 3 constituency seats. And that was generally brought in as a check and balance against extremist parties getting elected to the Bundestag in the wake of World War II.
Because the Nazis were democratically elected in their day.
Yeah. In 2013, just to show, like, we kind of wonder what's the most proportional system. Normally, a list system is probably more proportional than ours because traditionally, with the exception of the 2020 election, the biggest parties would have always got a bit of a bounce in terms of the number of seats in Irish elections. So Fianna Fáil would generally have won maybe about 40% of the vote, won maybe 46 or 47% of the seats, for instance. List systems are meant to try and avoid that bounce happening. The biggest bounce came in 2013 because two of the minor parties ended up winning 4.8% of the votes nationally. And because they didn't hit the 5% threshold, they ended up with nothing. So at the end, Angela Merkel got a few more seats than she had bargained for in that election because of that.
Yeah. What about, what else, what other areas would have interesting ways of picking a winner? Like the papal enclaves, is that a last man standing kind of thing?
I think that's, yeah. As far as my understanding, it's continual votes until you're left with the last, let's be honest, last man standing. Your vision is interesting as well, because there have been different voting rules brought in or means of deciding the winner used in Eurovision. And Eurovision is interesting because it shows you the impact of electoral systems.
Yeah.
That different rules for voting can result in different winners or different results. So, for instance, if the UK general election had happened, same results or same vote patterns in the UK general election had happened in Ireland, there's a good chance that Labour might have just won 40% of the seats. And we'd be looking now probably at a Labour-Liberal Democrat, possibly even Green coalition, maybe to make up the numbers, with the Conservative Reform coalition not too far behind them in terms of the total number of seats. In the case of Eurovision, up until, and this includes our heyday in Eurovision, generally voting in Eurovision up until the late 1990s was solely based on jury voting. In the late 1990s, 2000s, it was solely based on televoting. Now, since 2010, it's been 50% based on televoting, 50% based on jury voting. They've experimented a few ways with mixing those votes together. At the start, it was, okay, what's the top 10 in the televote? What's the top 10 in the jury vote? We'll add them together. Later on, it was, let's rank everyone's televote, every country's televote, every country's jury vote, and we'll combine those to give the results. Since 2016, they've kind of simplified it a bit more to say, okay, each country is a jury vote, each country is a televote, each country will give us jury vote and give us televote, and then at the end, we add all those votes together.
And if, for Eurovision, actually, that, you know, you could glance at it and say, oh, that's a... That's just a trivial yes, example. It's not the serious business of democracy. But inherent in it is one of the main challenges of democracy, because countries are different sizes. Eurovision, their various voting methods have been an attempt to prevent the country with the largest population always winning.
Yeah, and in fact, the country with the largest population at the moment, because Russia is no longer in Eurovision, would be Germany. You're at a disadvantage because you've got all those 80 million plus Germans who can't vote for Germany unless they're very cute one day and everyone on the Czech border just drove over into the Czechia and voted for Germany there. I think we did this happened in Ireland in what year was it? Mickey Joe Hart's year, 2003. He was from Lifford, remember?
Yeah.
And I think everyone in Lifford just walked across the bridge into Strabane and voted for Mickey Joe. But generally, the biggest countries are probably disadvantaged because there's 80 million voters in Germany, 60 million voters in the UK who can't vote for the country. There's some good checks and balances there. The jury voting was brought back in the late 2000s as another means of bringing checks and balances into the contest. So the perception back then was, oh, Eastern European countries are winning it all the time and it's all because of political voting, blah, 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 blah. Waffle, waffle, waffle. In reality, the Eastern Europeans were taking the contest seriously. And that's why they're winning so much in the 2000s. The knock-on effect of jury voting was, it actually, and this is one of the arguments I'd make about electoral systems, is you have to adapt to an electoral system. So when jury voting came back in, countries realized, okay, the sort of diggy-loo, diggy-lay entries that would get you a good result in pure televoting, they're not going to cut it anymore with the jury votes. Like, you could have a Diggy Lou, Diggy Lay entry that does well in the televote, but gets zero on the jury vote. And next thing you know, you're knocked out in the semi-final. So countries started to adapt. You started to see less of these novelty entries coming in, more sedate, more kind of conventional, more probably radio-friendly entries coming in the 2010s. What's interesting is they changed the system again last year for semi-finals. They went back to a pure televote, partly because there was a bit of a controversy with the jury voting in the previous year. Now, since then, I think you've started to see countries now moving away from the more safe conventional entries, and they're now taking risks. We saw it this year with Oz, with Bambi Thug.
Yeah.
Because, you know, if you send an entry like Bambi Thug, there's always a risk that the jury voters might mark it down because they, oh, it's not proper music, blah, 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 blah. But you'll always find a niche with the televoters. Televoters are more democratic in a lot of ways. Like, there's a lot of blather that the televoters are political, etc., etc. I'd argue probably jury voters are more political than the televoters. But televoters are more open to risky, more interesting entries, whereas the jury voters often, probably because in terms of their age profile, they're probably actually older on average than the normal Eurovision viewer. Jury voters tend to go for what's more safe and more conventional.
I'm thinking of all sorts of analogies here because I think about the wisdom of the crowd and the televote, you know, being an analogy to a citizens' assembly where, you know, a lot of people have lots of different opinions, but admittedly, a citizens' assembly comes to one decision, whereas obviously televoters have many decisions. But you get that complexity of opinion, whereas when you have a select group of people in the jury, you are prisoner to their biases and tastes or whatever. But what struck me, even just listening to you talk about it, and it is a slap in the face to anyone who would think that Eurovision is, you know, a trivial thing, is that in some ways, is Eurovision a bit like a giant experiment where you can see the effect of changes on a voting system, on outcome, without necessarily starting wars or cutting benefits, if you know what I mean? It's a giant continent-wide experiment in democracy where they've tinkered with it over the course of 15 to 20 years. It impacts the music that's produced, and music could be akin to policies. Like, I know there are obviously, I don't want to strain the metaphor too much, but as a geographer, is part of your interest in it the fact that it is a huge democratic experiment?
Yeah, it is. And it's obviously there's interesting elements that, as in a re-election, you will tend to find similar results cropping up in certain parts of Europe quite often. So we're more likely to do well with UK voters. So you get friends and neighbours voting. And not necessarily because it's political voting, but a lot of times because that's the type of music people in that part of Europe like. So Serbia, in the last Eurovision a few months ago, did quite well with countries that border them, Croatia, Slovenia, but didn't do very well with countries like Ireland because they had a very specific type of music, a Serbian Balkan ballad, basically, which does have an appeal for people in the Balkan region in Southeast Europe, but never seems to translate to Irish audiences. So there's interesting trends there that a lot of times are more down to cultural preferences than to out and out politics.
Is there anything from the Eurovision that should be brought in to the democratic system?
That's a good question. Like, should there be sort of a standalone jury vote along with a standalone popular vote? I suppose in a way, the jury vote, if we were to try and relate that somewhat to our elections, for me, the jury vote is probably the first stage of an election where you're selecting candidates.
Yeah.
So this is where you get the expert party opinion on who their best candidate is. In the case of America, it's probably the primary elections would be the closest thing to the jury vote.
Yeah. And speaking of America, I mean, we have chatted before about the American Electoral College, but just to bring it back before we go to geography, the big thing about America, of course, is it's a place where land has a vote, and yes. and a huge thing about voting is where do all the people live versus where all the land is. And as a geographer, when you look at somewhere like America, which has a system deliberately designed to prevent farmers in Idaho being oppressed by metropolitans in New York, like it's there for a good reason, like the tyranny of the majority and all that. What does a geographer think when they look at a system which gives rights to land?
Yeah, it's an interesting system. I suspect the rationale for the system made a lot more sense when it was first introduced in the late 1700s, early 1800s, than it does today. As a geographer, what's really fascinating here is when it comes to a presidential election, just how few states actually matter when it comes to the final result. So in the next few months, we'll be focusing on the USA. There's two things at the moment, the way it's going, there's two things likely to happen. A Trump landslide, or if it's a close contest, it's going to boil down to a few states. These are the states that call swing states. So in a normal presidential election, in a competitive presidential election, and there's been a lot of those in the last few decades, you will tend to find there's three types of states. So there's the red states, which generally tend to vote for the Republicans, the blue states, which generally tend to vote for the Democrats, and then our middle ground states, the swing states or the battleground states or the purple states, where you don't know the result. And these states are important because these are the states that get all the attention in the last few weeks and months of a presidential election. Because if you're the Democrat candidate, you're not going to waste your time, or you shouldn't be wasting your time in California. You know there's a lot of electoral college votes in California, but you know as the Democrat candidate, you're going to win California. So why chase votes? Why chase electoral college votes? You know you're going to win. Why waste time there? If you spend time campaigning in California, all it means is you win California by a bigger number of surplus votes. That doesn't do anything for you. If you go to Idaho, where you know it's a red state, it's a Republican state, you're not going to win there, no matter how hard you campaign. If you do campaign there a lot, you might lose by a smaller margin. But that's only increasing your number of wasted votes.
Yeah.
So the trick to the American winning in the American system is chasing effective votes, the votes that will matter in terms of helping you to win electoral college votes and ultimately win the election. And obviously, the place to go for those are these swing states. Now, in a normal election, the number of swing states is usually starts off at around 11, 12, 13. And then the last few weeks, it all boils down to maybe six or seven different states. Even at this point in time, if it's going to be a competitive election, I suspect it might really just boil down to five states in the upcoming election. Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania in the Midwest, and Arizona and Georgia. So it's really, you're really talking about a very small proportion or percentage of the total number of states in America. Possibly, 10% of all the states. And they're not even the biggest states either.
Yeah, so even a smaller percentage of the population.
A much smaller percentage of the population. So it's a strange system, a very strange. It's fascinating from a geographer because you can get into talk about vote distribution efficiency, which is the best party at trying to campaign in the places where votes matter the most, and which party gets its campaign strategy wrong. In the last two elections, funnily enough, Trump won 2016, Trump lost in 2020. But in terms of strategy, there's a concept used by electoral geographers and political sciences called bias. Is there bias in the system, in an electoral system? Bias effectively suggests that you get bias in an election, if you have a scenario where if two candidates ended up in the same number of votes, one candidate would win a bigger number of electoral college votes in that scenario. So there is bias in American presidential elections. It's not like It's none to do with gerrymandering, which relates to congressional elections. A lot of times the bias is just down to sometimes bad luck, sometimes voter turnout. But a lot of times it's down to which party is the smartest at getting out voters where it really matters.
Yeah.
In 2020, we'll all remember Joe Biden won the 2020 election by over 7 million votes. But this contest really boiled down to three very close contests in the states of Wisconsin, Arizona, and Georgia. One state, the margin was 11,779 votes. Another state, it was 10,457 votes. And Wisconsin is 20,682 votes. So even though Biden won the election by over 7 million votes, if 21,461 voters had changed their minds and voted Trump instead of Biden in those states, the final result in the Electoral College would have been 269 Biden, 269 Trump, and the result would then have been decided in the House of Congress, and Trump would have been voted President of America by the House of Congress, Kamala Harris would have been voted Vice President by the Senate, and that would have been the final result. So it's a very strange, very unbalanced system.
And so inherently unfair, I suppose, because of the amount of people whose votes make no difference.
True.
Or do we care? Fundamentally, do you have a view on fairness? Is the definition of fairness, does it depend on who's defining it?
Yeah, that's a really interesting philosophical question. Personally, I like our system because in our system, there is a sense that your vote really matters in our system. There is a sense that no matter what constituency you're in, your vote can actually have an impact on the final result. Your vote could actually be the vote that decides whether you have a Sinn Féin-led government after the next election or a Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael-led government after the next election. So we don't have this strange scenario of safe constituencies, as you get in parts of the UK, or safe states, the red states, blue states, as you get in the USA. Like in our electoral system, you do get the sense that every vote matters. Your vote could be the one vote that decides who takes the last seat in that constituency, because we've had a few scenarios in recent Irish elections where the final seat has been decided by a small number of votes.
Yeah.
And Holly Cairns' political career was decided by just one vote, for instance. In the 2019 local elections in Bantry, West Cork, she won the final seat by just one vote after a number of recounts.
Wow.
And since then, she went on to win a seat in the general election. She found it easier to win in the general election than the local elections. And she's now the leader of the Social Democrats. So one little vote can make a big difference. And I suspect that one vote might have been possibly a fifth preference or a sixth preference or a seventh preference.
Yeah.
So our votes, I think, I like our system. Our votes, I know when I'm going to vote, I have a lot more influence over the final result in the constituency, but potentially at a national level, than you will have, for instance, in the case of a voter going to vote in California in the USA, because they know whether they're Republican or Democrat, their vote really doesn't matter. The Democrats are going to win California, and the real action is taking place in probably in just five states, Arizona, Georgia, Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania.
Okay, we're going to watch those over the next while. There's only 6 months.
Only six five, months.
Even less, maybe 4.5 months of nonstop mentions of those states. Thanks so much, Adrian Kavanagh, for taking us around the world in 100 votes. Thanks, Adrian.
Thanks, Colm.
That's Adrian Kavanagh there. My thanks to him. He took a break from being in the middle of studying turnout in local elections in inner city Dublin in order to talk to me. What can I say? The man loves elections. That's it for the Function Room this time. Slowly increasing the frequency of episodes. Please remember to review, like, subscribe, spread the word however you spread the word, by vicious rumour, pigeon, shards of pottery, flaming arrows, whatever is your method. Thanks to those of you who got in contact. Thanks to Christ or Christ Van Villigan for your lovely comments on the podcast. Also, hi to Jane Dawson Howe for telling me how much she likes the episodes, particularly around the areas of renewable energy. And she's a big fan of Dr. Volt's David Roberts as well too. So am I. So do check out his podcast as well too. But for now, if you want to, leave a review on your favourite podcast app du jour. You can find me on Instagram, Colm O'Regan Comedy, and on Twitter at Colm O'Regan. Get in contact wherever you want, on email as well to hello@colmoregan.com. But for now, until next time, bye.